Welcome to another episode of Loopcasts. Today, my guest of honor is Ben Brooks. Ben is the founder and CEO of Pilot, an award-winning employee career development software platform.
Hi, Ben.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm starting out the week in a great mood, getting to talk to you, being a conversation about possibilities, so I'm pretty excited.
Awesome. I'll shoot away with one of my favorite questions. The first one is, give me three habits, Ben, that you think best affect your performance at work and keeps you sane at the same time.
One of them is very simple, which is keeping a clean workspace. Order, you know, everything in its place, things being clean and tidy gives me so much calm before I even do my work. Another habit I have is I meditate every day. I have not missed a day in many, many years. I'm a Vedic meditator and had my 20 minutes earlier this morning. And it's a great way to feel in control before I even start working, much like keeping things tidy and orderly. And, you know, also, you know, really being focused in terms of, you know, if I am on the screen with you today, I'm not going to have a bunch of other windows open. I minimize things, turn off notifications so I can monotask and do one thing at once.
Okay, love the three. So what happens when you're overwhelmed or unfocused though? So if you lost your focus temporarily at work, let's say, what do you do?
You know, there's a temptation I have, this is to push forward, to push through. But what I find is it just gets worse. So there's a bit of stopping and surrendering that works. And a big thing is just to go outside for me. That just, I go on the roof of my building here in Manhattan and New York City. I'll walk around the block. I'll pick up a cup of coffee. I'll listen to a song or listen to a podcast. 15, 20 minutes, not long. But the idea of just getting fresh air, getting up from my desk, moving, getting away from my workspace is a big part of that. If it's in the afternoon, sometimes I'll meditate again. If I'm really under a lot of stress, and I may have a lot of anxiety, perhaps, I will even journal and I'll just write down sort of all of the thoughts that are swirling through my head, concerns, fears, doubts, negative predictions, worries. And there's something very cathartic about just getting them on paper so they have a place to live besides, you know, the front of my mind. And so there's a variety of different things that I do in that regard to get focused. The other thing is sometimes I'll be unfocused because I'll be working on, you know, five or six things, or I won't know where to start. And so I just try to then pick a particular thing, often the easiest, simplest thing. It's sort of like getting, you know, some momentum. And so I'll have a thing where I need to pay a bill online and it'll take 2 minutes and I log in and I use my credit card and I'll just have a small win or a small thing and say, okay, I'm in the groove. Things are happening and I'll just then get to the next thing and I'll work on harder things from there.
Awesome. Okay. The next question is about, like, this sounds all so put together, but sometimes, you know, like you feel like you're not in control of your own calendar, right? Like there are so many meetings to attend, like so many phone calls to return to, like so many WhatsApp messages. I don't know what you use, by the way. Mm-hmm. But how do you keep that from not happening? And if that happens, what do you do? Because like there's a whole, I call this the time affluence crisis. Like we all want to have time affluence, but it seems like we can't have it because like there's so much like digital nagging on our back. So yeah.
Well, you know, Stoic wisdom, you know, that's another thing that I follow the Stoics and learn more about Stoic wisdom and Seneca to quote, it's not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste a lot of it. And in particular, it's easier than ever for someone to get our attention for instantly for no cost. You know, it used to be, you know, 100 years ago to send a telegram or to place a phone call or to send a letter was quite expensive. Yeah. So if someone wanted to get a hold of you, they were pretty serious.
Right.
Now, if someone has a thought, they're in your WhatsApp, they're in your email, they're in your Slack, they're in your Facebook Messenger, they're right in front of you. And so part of it is to not confuse inbound stimulus or communication with work.
Wow.
Okay. Of course, the communication is very important for relationships and things, but you know, getting control over that is you know, I find that I had a big insight about a year ago is that I'm a very creative person and I see the possibility in almost everything. Mm-hmm. Problem is I'll get an invite to a webinar or a newsletter, or I'll see an article or a social media post, or someone will reach out to me. And instead of it being, if I was in a brainstorming meeting, I say, oh, that's an idea. Let's put on a post-it note. Let's put it on the wall. It's in the menu of ideas. But it's sort of, when you brainstorm, that you then prioritize and you pick a few things based on some criteria, realizing you can't do everything. You're going to have 100 ideas and you're going to pick five. Well, I tend to collapse brainstorming and the prioritization in my mind in the flow of work, because I'll say, oh, this is good, I'll do it. And I don't compare it to all the other opportunities. I'll say yes to a meeting, to meeting somebody. So part of it is slowing down and not just saying yes to things in the flow of work. And then with my calendar, I have an assistant I work with who's trained me quite well, that we look at my calendar, we get it scheduled the week before. So we seek to have my entire calendar built the Friday before the week ahead. And then we review every single meeting to make sure the right attendees are going to be there, that the Zoom link is set up. Do I need to be there? Is there preparation? Are there things in advance? Because what will often happen is a lot of time is wasted when we show up to a meeting and the wrong people are in the meeting and the right people are not there. The link doesn't work. No one has the file. The follow-up wasn't done. And so all of a sudden, an hour of my day is gone and there's little value. But if we get in front of it, and the calendar review takes 5 minutes. It's a 5-minute practice. We do it every single week. It also gives me some calm because I know what I'm walking into, because most people will look at their calendar the night before at best, or often on the way to work or in the morning as they're kind of drinking coffee and go, oh crap, what's my day today? And that kind of has you on your back foot versus your front foot. And that's a big thing I found makes a difference.
Oh my God, this made a huge difference. So we've been having this, the Loopcasts, and this is the 7th episode. And what I've heard so far is the daily one that you just suggested. Like right before I go to bed, I look at my calendar for tomorrow, but this is very fresh. I love that.
Yep.
Because I also received an email from your assistant on Friday.
Yep.
You know, confirming our email and our Zoom link. So true and so simple.
So simple, but it makes a difference, because imagine if we had a miscommunication, you know, you're in a different continent than me. And so we had a miscommunication about date or time or preparedness, or I hadn't gotten to review questions. We'd either not have the podcast or have a really crappy podcast. And then you'd be stressed or I'd be stressed or we'd both be stressed. And maybe we have to reschedule it, which creates all this extra work.
True.
And there's something about, you know, being prepared and that anticipation to say, okay, like if we're going to have this meeting to review a certain slide deck on Wednesday, will the deck be done in advance? Will I have a chance to look at it in advance? And so there's just this sense of anticipation and planning that most people don't do when they manage their time. They just look at more of it is if the calendar tells them where they need to be next. Oh, I have a 10-minute pop-up on Google Calendar or Outlook. That means I need to get off of this call or walk down the office to this person's, you know, rather than pulling up and saying, oh, this is what I've committed to spend my time on. How do I make sure I get a good return on my time?
Wow, I love this. It's so simple. And it's so easy, and therein comes the power of it. I love that. Beautiful. Okay, so this is more of a like vision question rather than a practical one. So if you could have a gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would it say and why, Ben?
Well, I probably have a lot of different thoughts on that. You know, Pilot, my company, we have an employee development and coaching platform. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the mission of our company is for everyone to feel powerful at work. Mm-hmm. Really feeling powerful is less about anointing someone power through title or compensation or things, but more an inside out feeling. And part of me would love to have a billboard that everyone drives by on the way to work or is on the train and things and just says, it's a great day to feel powerful at work.
Okay, beautiful.
You know, I've had it, you know, it's a great day to have a great day. I love that quote. You know, there's a group I work with that's working on ending the AIDS epidemic, and we'll start meetings and I'll say, it's a great day to end the AIDS epidemic. And there's just this sense of declaring something
right.
versus, oh, I don't know how today's going to go. Let's see. I'm not sure is a very sort of passive, the world happens to me mindset. And I think the idea of feeling in control of how a day is going to be and a reminder that it's a daily practice or choice, because when people feel powerful at work, they also feel powerful often in other parts of their lives. They solve problems, they have greater well-being, they're happier, they're more effective, their performance increases, their careers advance. So I think that's what I'd say. It's a great day to feel powerful at work.
I love the word you use there, because like you're choosing to define the day, and hence you're giving it like not as a, you know, you're not looking at it passively, but proactively, which I love. Okay. So let me ask you one more thing. So I know there are people you're working with. Do you impose any rules on yourself to keep their well-being at bay?
So a couple things that are simple but important. So we've got a 100% remote team. We've got people in multiple, all over the United States, but all in many countries, and people in Europe and across North America. And we have people that work full-time and people that work part-time.
Right.
So in a remote culture, it's very important. Most people that have been doing remote due to the pandemic haven't really developed a true remote culture. They've tried to do in-person work virtually, which is why everyone's burned out and working 2 more hours per day to get their jobs done, et cetera. One thing that we know is really important is flexibility.
Okay.
And in particular, we have a majority female workforce, and it's even more important for women, but it's important for everyone. And so to have the culture where people can say, oh, I'm not available then, or I have a thing, or I'm busy. And it's a balance, you know, but if they're a committed, trusted employee that they need to pick up their kid at the school bus, that they don't have to miss out on doing that because they have a meeting, or there's a way that they'll listen to the recording, or they'll dial in instead of being on Zoom. So I think the flexibility is a big one. Another is when people take vacation, because we have cloud technologies that work on our phone, everything we could do at our company, we can kind of do on our phones now.
True.
I make sure that people don't say, oh, I'll log in, I'll just check, I don't need an out of office. You know, we say, hey, everyone has to have an out of office message with someone to back up for them. I don't really want you working on vacation. There's a thing you were going to do, like schedule an email to send for marketing. Let's find someone else to do that. And so it's really instilling the discipline, because I have a bunch of hardworking, dedicated employees, but they'll sometimes choose to work on their vacation. They say, oh, well, it'd be good to get a break from my family and this and that. But what I know about myself is I may have a 1 hour thing to do on my vacation, 1 hour for the whole week. I will think about it for 20 hours that week.
So true.
And so I want them to have none of that. So that's a very important thing. And then another thing is to also just, you know, align expectations around emails and Slack and things. I work late often. I have very hardworking employees, but no one's going to care more about the company than the founder. And so I work late. I don't expect everyone to work as late as I do. But if I'm sending emails at 10 o'clock at night internally, and frankly, even to our customers or vendors, most of the time I'm going to send those as timed emails, meaning that I'll schedule them to land in their inbox first thing in the morning. Right. Because even if they know that they don't have to reply on Sunday night, if they see an email from the CEO or a key partner or whatever, even if they don't reply, they're going to read it. They're going to think about it. They may have feelings about it. Then they're going to mark it unread. And then they're going to do the same process again tomorrow. So, and again, it'll mess up their evening. So a big part of it is not even, you know, oftentimes they say, oh, well, just, you know, people put on their email signature, reply when you're free. Well, that's great. But the more empathetic thing is to think about send it during work hours and have the flexibility for people to reply when they can.
Absolutely. Is there like, when I'm doing these podcasts, there are usually very interesting examples of well-being hacks that come up. For example, one executive mentioned how they looked one another's pets during COVID, because this was something that really like calmed them down during the, especially at the onset of the pandemic. Is there a surprising well-being hack that worked for your entire workforce?
There's many that, you know, again, well-being can be different by person. You have someone who has kids and doesn't have kids. Well-being hack may look different for them. Mm-hmm. Someone who's you know, younger versus older, someone who has a medical condition versus not. So I think part of it is to not assume it's always a one size fits all or fits most, but there are some things that can work across the board. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we talk about well-being a lot in the sense of the physical. Mm-hmm. We should get enough sleep. We should have enough steps. We should reduce sodium. We should, you know, monitor our heart rate. And those are very important things.
Right.
But I focus a lot on the psychological and the emotional part of well-being. And part of well-being, for instance, is feeling like you're doing a good job. Mm-hmm. To eliminate that gnawing sense of, am I good enough? Am I advancing? Am I growing? Am I valued at the organization? Am I going to keep my job? These are things that can affect someone's well-being if they're sitting up at night worrying about these things.
Right.
So every month for 3 years now, we do monthly accomplishments. And we have a big whiteboard, a virtual whiteboard.
Oh, and we my God, great idea.
And we say, by department, what happened that was good? What did you accomplish? And there's no accomplishment too small is the rule.
Wow.
So people will say, hey, we implemented a new sales tax software. We hired this consultant. We figured out a better way to streamline getting invoices out. We had a great customer meeting about this. We had a partnership with this person. And it gives everyone a sense of accomplishment and contribution. But then we see it in totality. In the conclusion, every single time, you know, we've done this now probably 36 times, is, wow, we got more done than I realized. I feel really good.
Oh, wow.
It's one of those things, it's like watching a show that you've watched a million times or a movie, you know exactly how it's going to go, but it's so pleasurable to watch it. And that is a hack, is doing that as a team, is that feeling of accomplishment. And then another well-being hack is that we've been working on different skills that allow us to have better communication and have better conflict. One of the things one of our advisors, you know, said is, if you have a startup or you're an innovative company or a new product, you have to develop people around having effective conflict. Mm-hmm. And he said, you think of startup, you think of something sexy and cool and, you know, bleeding edge. But the reality is you're going to, you know, have a lot of change all the time. You're going to have disagreements, sure, misalignment with customers, with vendors internally. So we've been working through a book called Crucial Conversations, and we do a book club, and we do a book club in Slack. And so every week we do a chapter, company pays for the book. And if people want an audio book or a Kindle or paper copy, we give them whatever, you know, format they prefer. And everyone has a different preference, believe it or not. And then every week we have accountability to each other that we're all going to read a chapter and put our notes in there in Slack, and then we discuss it. So that way if future team members join and they want to do it, they can join the book club after the fact and go through it. And so we're just learning a lot of great skills that allow us to have conversations where the stakes are high, you know, emotions run strong, and there's differing opinions, which happens all the time. And that's a well-being thing that, for instance, yes, I want to have people, you know, have lower sodium and get steps in, and those are very important. But I also know if someone's very anxious about having a conflict with the vendor, that can ruin their day, that really affects their well-being. And if they had better skills and more confidence about how to navigate that, that would impact their well-being. And that's something that we can do at work. That's not just an employee benefit, but it changes the way that people do work, so they have better well-being as they're doing work.
I love this. Wow. You're walking the talk. I love that.
We're trying to, at least.
Yes. So this is more personal though. So what is one of the best or most worthwhile investments you've ever made?
Probably, broadly speaking, in myself. Mm-hmm. There's economists have studied different asset classes and returns on different investments. And the number one research highest rated return is entrepreneurs that invest in themselves. Mm-hmm. So whether that's starting my own business, but more importantly, you know, working with a coach. Mm-hmm. I see a therapist every week. I see a therapist because I want to play offense and get better and be challenged. Mm-hmm. Or I've worked with media trainers or speaking trainers to help me get better speeches, or worked with people to help. I hired a certified professional organizer once, mm-hmm, someone to help me get organized. And I realized the importance of being very organized. So I think those are the things that I think have been the best, where I've really figured out how do I get support. And it's not always, I mean, there's things I can learn from a book, and that's great, and we like that. But sometimes I need more hands-on. When I'm doing a keynote speech. I had a guy that I flew in from Minneapolis, a few hour flight from New York City. And, you know, we sat in a room on a dreary Saturday in the winter and worked for 12 hours straight of me practicing. And about 8 hours in, I burst into tears. And he goes, okay, this that happens every time. He said every client he works with. And part of the method is to exhaust the person until they get to the other side. And okay. So when Steve said that happened, he sort of laughed. He said, well, this is a good sign. We needed to get to this point. But that's part of the growth. And I'm a much better professional speaker as a result of my work with that individual. And so that's a thing that so often we're focused on either other people or, you know, we'll make investments, you know, to say, well, we're going to have new headcount. We're going to hire somebody, or we're going to buy this new piece of software, or we're going to give everybody raises or new benefits. And those are all good things. But part of it is to say, well, what do I need? Even if it's as simple as me having, I have meals delivered every week. On Sunday, there's a service that delivers meals and they're very healthy and they're in my fridge. And during the week, during lunch, I work so much that I'll eat poorly. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a lot of time, or I'll skip meals and I won't be at my best. And so as of Sunday night, I have, you know, lunch every day is in my fridge. And all I have to do is either microwave it, eat it cold. It's healthy. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. And it's so much better than what I would do otherwise. But that's an investment. And I have to create a process around that. So it's sort of, again, getting in front of things rather than being reactive to them.
This all sounds incredible and it's so inspiring. I just want to know one thing going forward before I ask any more questions. What is the one thing you're trying to crack right now? Like, is there one thing? Like, this sounds all like so inspiring. Like, I will and like I've been having these talks over and over with so many different professionals, amazing professionals, and this just sounds book perfect. Is there one thing you're trying to crack at the moment?
It's about 30, which is probably part of the problem. we always have more to figure out than we've got figured out. True. More in our don't know than our know column sometimes. You know, a big thing that I'm working on, obviously, with our company is growth and how do we grow our company. We haven't taken venture capital funding. We get offered funding all the time, but we're taking, we want a very sustainable company. We want a company that endures. We're not looking to sell our company, but then it also means we're not pouring, you know, tens of, or hundreds of millions into marketing, go to market. So that's a big thing we're cracking right now. We have a product that people love and that they use and employees revere and helps everyone be successful. So that's a thing. And so then what I have to confront on the personal level on that is things we've tried, where I've been frustrated, what I might be afraid of, needing to ask for help from others. And that's my call right after this. I've got two calls today with people that are like, okay, here's how we're gonna help you hire or consult or do software or advise or all these different things. So as much as it's a practical challenge for us to solve, to continue to grow, there's also then the emotional part for me to figure out how do I kind of steady myself as we're in a learning mode.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question maybe related to this. Why no VC funding?
So it's a choice. You know, I live in New York and we've got a lot of venture capital and private markets and private equity, et cetera. And there's nothing wrong with VC funding, but it requires a company to have one of two paths. It either has to be acquired or it has to go public.
Okay.
Those are the only two paths. So you can go public, you know, SPAC, direct listing, IPO. There's a couple different subpaths in that. But essentially, your company will not be yours in the future if you're an entrepreneur. And so, you know, I look at, for instance, Mike Bloomberg founded Bloomberg LP, is kind of a business, you know, role model for me. You know, he still retains, I don't know, 70, 80% of his company. It's a private company. He's been able to do some very interesting things with it. And so, you know, I really am committed that we have a great company and a great product. And I don't want to have to fight maybe investors worried about short-term things or, you know, there's all sorts of things we could chase that may be more exciting or interesting temporarily. But I think we're solving a more fundamental, much like you're doing with your business around wellness and well-being, ours around kind of, you know, career success and satisfaction and happiness, that it's the thing that's going to require long-term commitment rather than short-term gain. And venture capitalists are typically looking at, you know, short-term gain. They want, you know, things to go as fast as possible. And there's also just a way that, you know, we're really committed to diversity. We're committed, you know, venture capital is going primarily, it's, you know, 95% to men, and it's going mostly to white folks, mostly to people that are in certain backgrounds that went to, if you went to Harvard or Stanford, I think that, you know, something like 70 or 80%, don't quote me exactly, but the, in the United States, I mean, there's just, it's a very narrow group of people. And so as an out gay founder, you know, we're one of the few enterprise SaaS businesses in the United States, at least, that has an out founder and it's certified LGBT owned. And so that's a part of why we haven't taken that path. And again, it's we get offers all the time for money. It's we just have never taken a single fundraising meeting. It's not that we failed at it. We've never tried. And there's just other ways. And my biggest thing is I'd like to grow our company by having a great product that we sell for more than it costs for us to deliver. So it's profitable and we use those profits, and that's fundamentally a sustainable business.
Wow. Okay. By the way, that number is 97.8% male.
There you go. Okay. So yeah, so you know exactly. Yeah. So I said 95 plus. So it's almost 98%.
And unfortunately, yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's a pattern recognition business. And so venture capital partners will say, oh, well, you know, we invested in, you know, 20 companies and two of them were blockbusters and three of them were okay and the rest failed. That's fine. They can make plenty of money. They'll say, well, what happened with those companies? Oh, well, they were engineering majors from Stanford that were men and they may have been white. And they'll say, we need to find more white engineering Stanford. And it's subconscious, right? It's not like venture capital firms are looking at that level of architecture, but that's the pattern. And if someone comes in and they're an immigrant from Nigeria, or they're a woman from, you know, Missouri or Turkey or wherever, it may not make as much sense to them. And that's less the kind of environment or ecosystem I want to be in right now.
Wow. Okay. And maybe one more question before we wrap it all up. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
I love Wikipedia articles.
Okay.
And I love getting to the bottom of things. Mm-hmm. And so I will travel with my partner. We went to our first Broadway show in about 2 years on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And it was about a real life event. And so then at dinner, we go to the Wikipedia thing that it was all inspired by the real life event. And I find all sorts of, then this happened and the mother did this and they were hospitalized and that related to this person and they got divorced because, and I just love going, there's a Instagram account about strange Wikipedia pages that I follow as well. And I just love, it's not just Wikipedia is my only source, but it tends to be the easiest one that I can consistently get a nice summary of things. And so whether it's a building we're in or an island we're visiting or a business that we're working with, or it's a phenomenon, I love going deep in the kind of a Wikipedia hole and just learning even the tiniest little details about something. I find this sort of curiosity swirl.
It's interesting that you love Wikipedia because it sort of like fits with your whole idea of the world. Like the way you express why you don't want to take any VC money strangely correlates with Wiki and Wiki's story too, I believe, yep. Because yeah, you know, yes. The entire Wiki story. Okay.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe one more. In the last 5 years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Probably starting with the facts. Mm-hmm. I've always been a pretty data-driven, fact-based person, but sometimes I would start with my feelings or my concerns or my desires or my worries, or I'd say, what do I need to do? I'm a very action-oriented person. So that's often the primary thing I'm asking myself is, what's next? What's the next step? What do I have to do? What's the plan? And in the last 5 years, slowing down a bit to say, well, what do I know? What are the facts? You know, I'll be worried about business. I'll think, oh, are we not spending enough on the product? Or are our customers happy enough? Then I'll think, oh, what should we spend more on the product? Should we do more to, you know, reach out to our customers? But if I start with the facts and I say, oh, well, our increasing on product spend is actually a greater percentage than any other area in our company. And I start with the facts and I say, okay. Or I look at our customers and I say, oh, well, actually our net promoter score is higher than it's ever been. And it's higher than, you know, Wharton and you know, all sorts of different organizations that we benchmark against. And then it says, oh, well, maybe actually there's no action to take there. Maybe I want to do even more, but it may be that I do something else. And I think, you know, not having, again, that brainstorming impulse of an idea or a fear or a suggestion then catapults into another thing on my to-do list, because most of my to-do list I generate.
Right.
And I have a to-do list that's consistently too long. So what I need to do is not figure out how to do more on the list, but put less on the list. And when I start with the facts, it helps me put less on the list because I'm clearer about what's so and what's not and what needs to be done. And it's often very sobering. And it's not like I need a lot of data. The facts is not pages and pages and pages. It's often 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's often very clear and sobering and clarifying about what to do.
Most of it hits so close to home. So thank you so much for all of this. I have to ask one more thing. I know we have only very, very little time left. What are some bad recommendations you hear in your profession? And what would you tell people instead?
A lot of bad recommendations out there about careers and how to advance, et cetera. One is follow your passion. Very bad recommendation. People are passionate about all sorts of things. Sometimes there's too much of a good thing. You follow your passion and you hate it then. There's also things that we love to do or that we're passionate about, we're not that good at. And they're not the way that we should have our economic security centered. And so following your passion is generally something that, you know, rich people will tell you to do, but it's not a great path. You know, another one is, you know, there's a lot of talk about work-life balance and work-life integration. But sometimes I'm hearing 22 and 23-year-olds just out of university or just starting jobs worried far more about that than learning. And so they'll have great work-life balance, but their career peaks when they're 24. Mm-hmm. Their income, their learning. Mm-hmm. And that may be fine for certain people, again, based on what they want to do in life or what they have obligations outside of work. That may work for them, but for many people, it doesn't. And so that's one that I think... there's not enough advice that says go work your tush off, you know, work your butt off for your first 10 or 15 years of your career to maximize your learning, to figure out what you really want to do before you have kids or dogs and spouses and houses and everything else. Life is much simpler in that regard. There's another sense that I think there's a lot of sense that the company that people work for, their employer, has answers. There's a sense of like, HR, your manager, that there's some people behind a curtain figuring out what's best for you. And the reality is most people don't have any sense. They're not thinking about you. They're not against you, but they're worried about them. And so I think that assuming that people are thinking about you for the next project or what your next role is, or if your promotion, or if you have the right feedback, you should sort of assume that people are not. And that you need to take that responsibility and engage in those conversations. And I think the last thing is to not confuse new jobs or new titles as career advancement. On LinkedIn or on our resumes, I can say, oh, I was a manager and I was a director and I was an assistant vice president and I was a vice president. And it looks like, wow, that person's really progressing. Mm-hmm. But if they're in environments where they're toxic environments, their well-being is poor, they're not satisfied, maybe they're not even learning the right skills, or they're just jumping between companies every 18 months because they've never really been successful anywhere, so they have to find a new job, that, you know, really thinking about how do you stay at a job. Sometimes I always think 3 years is a very good time to stay at a job as a minimum. First year, you're just learning. You're not even adding value practically. Second year, you think you're adding value and you're doing okay. Third year, it really comes together. And so to really focus less on the titles and the jumps and the pay and more about learning and skills and relationships.
This was all very simple, so fresh and so exciting. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate you having me on as a guest.
Yes, this was Ben Brooks on Loopcast. And thank you so much, Ben, again.